Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save big money at
Menards. Crime and Crime Again is a true crime podcast containing subject matter that may be graphic or disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. On the morning of Sunday, June 3rd, 1990, many of the 600,000 residents of Milwaukee, Wisconsin were rolling out of bed to brew their coffee and start their day. One man awoke around 8:30 a.m. to find an unfamiliar red car parked outside of his home on North 49th Street. When he went outside to investigate, he was alarmed to find a young woman in the passenger seat of the car, slumped over toward the driver's side. Assuming that she was simply unconscious and needed help, the man knocked on the passenger window but received no response. He then pulled the door handle to discover that the car was unlocked. But when he felt for a pulse on the young woman and felt nothing at all, he closed the car door and immediately called the police. Within minutes, police arrived on the scene and confirmed that the woman was in fact deceased. Upon searching the car, they found various personal items strewn about, including the woman's purse and wallet. They were quickly able to identify the woman as 21-year-old Beth Beege. Beth Eileen Beege was born on May 16, 1969 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and she was actually adopted by the Beege family when she was just 5 weeks old. Her brother, Bruce, was 3 years old when they welcomed Beth into the family, and the two grew up with a close bond. In high school, Beth was a talented gymnast and even once took home a state championship win. She graduated from Vincent High School in 1987 and soon started a job with Rogers & Holland Jewelers, where she worked for 2 years. She then worked jobs as a cocktail waitress at Club Maryland and the Tijuana Yacht Club before deciding to take some time to travel around the country. Beth returned to Milwaukee, Wisconsin for her brother Bruce's wedding to his wife Dawn, but she wasn't fully committed to staying in her hometown. It wasn't until she landed a job at Fox Jewelers in Milwaukee, where she was on track to work her way up to management, that she decided to stay in her home city after all. Her brother's wedding turned out to be the start of another adventure for Beth. When the wedding photographer saw some of the photos taken of Beth at the wedding, she suggested that Beth might find success as a model. And by the summer of 1990, Beth was putting together a modeling portfolio. Everyone who knew Beth described her as one of the brightest, most bubbly, and kind-hearted people they had ever known. It was very rare to see her without a smile on her face. She was a hard worker and she had big dreams for her life. But on the morning of June 3rd, 1990, investigators in Milwaukee were tasked with figuring out who had taken Beth's life and shattered those big dreams. Beth was found in the passenger seat of her car, slumped over toward the driver's side with no seatbelt on. She was fully clothed and the button on her pants was still fastened, indicating that it was unlikely that there had been a sexual assault. There was bruising to the left side of her jaw, and bruising to both sides of her neck. There were also small, crescent-shaped abrasions on both sides of her neck, which appeared to be indentations from fingernails. Investigators found cash in Beth's wallet, leading them to believe that robbery was not the motive for her murder. There was no blood, fingerprints, or other forensic evidence found in the car, and there were no signs that a struggle had taken place in the vehicle. Police started canvassing the neighborhood, and they found one woman who was awake taking care of her baby sometime between 6 and 6:30 a.m., just a couple of hours before the neighborhood became a crime scene. The woman told police that she remembered seeing the red car driving past her house, and it was making jerky motions, as though the driver didn't know how to drive a stick shift. She specifically recalled the distinctive license plate on Beth's car, FLRT-12. She described the driver of the car as a white male with brown hair wearing glasses. Beth's autopsy determined that her cause of death was manual strangulation. Manner of death, homicide. Rigor mortis had not yet set in when police arrived at the scene and discovered Beth, and the medical examiner confirmed that Beth had been murdered less than 4 hours before she was found. When investigators searched Beth's apartment, they found no evidence that a struggle or a murder had occurred there either. At that point, investigators believed that Beth was not murdered in her car or her apartment, but somewhere else entirely. They were now tasked with finding the actual scene of the crime. A tip came in that Beth's ex-boyfriend had called her family, asking for information about the case and whether or not police had any leads. This concerned the police enough to look further into her ex-boyfriend. Beth and this ex-boyfriend had broken up about 6 months before her murder. They learned that on the afternoon of June 2nd, 1990, the day before Beth was found in her car, she had called her ex-boyfriend from Fox Jewelers where she worked, but it wasn't clear what the conversation was about. That night, Beth left work around 6:30 p.m. Around 8 p.m., she called her ex-boyfriend again from a payphone. The ex-boyfriend told police that Beth was trying to make plans with him that night, but that he wasn't able to meet up with her. According to her ex-boyfriend, on the night of June 2, 1990, he was actually driving from Milwaukee, Wisconsin to Chicago, Illinois, to pick up his live-in girlfriend from her night shift job. He stated that he arrived in Chicago at 4 a.m. and he and his girlfriend were back home in Milwaukee around 5:30 a.m. The girlfriend confirmed his story. Investigators soon learned that Beth's ex-boyfriend was also adopted, and that she was working with him to find both of their birth parents, which likely explained the reason Beth wanted to meet up with him that night. Police kept the ex-boyfriend on their radar, but quickly moved on to a suspect they found far more viable.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save big money
at Menards. At the time of her murder, Beth had been dating one of her co-workers at Fox Jewelers for about 3 weeks. On the episode of On the Case with Paula Zahn that covered Beth's case, they referred to her boyfriend only by first name, and I found it incredibly difficult to confirm whether or not that was his actual first name. I suspect there was a reason they chose not to use his full name and that there is a reason his name is so hard to find online. For that reason, I will be referring to Beth's boyfriend at the time of her murder as Jay. Please note that is not his actual name, but I was unable to confirm his actual name in my research. Investigators learned that on June 2, 1990, after leaving work and making that phone call to her ex-boyfriend, Beth ended up going to her current boyfriend Jay's apartment. They planned to watch a movie that night. When police arrived at her boyfriend's apartment, they learned that 19-year-old Jay lived with his mother in an apartment above a restaurant, known as Jake's Restaurant at the time. Jay's mother was actually a manager at the restaurant. Investigators also noted that Jay's apartment was only about 8 minutes away from where Beth's car was found. Jay's mother told police that he wasn't home, but that she was willing to talk with them. She confirmed that when she arrived home from work around 11 p.m. on the night of June 2nd, Beth and Jay were on the couch watching a movie and laughing. Jay's mother went to bed almost immediately after arriving home, and she claimed that she actually had trouble falling asleep because the TV was so loud. She had to ask Beth and Jay to turn it down. She claimed that when she was waking up between 6 and 6:30 a.m. the next morning, she heard what sounded like footsteps heading toward the front door to leave. She assumed it was Beth leaving, but she didn't actually get out of bed to see who it was. She fell back asleep for a while, and when she woke up again around 8 a.m., she noted that Beth was gone and that Jay was still in bed asleep. According to Jay's mother, he woke up and got ready for work around 9:50 a.m. and left shortly thereafter. Police wanted to speak with Jay as soon as possible, so they planned to go to Fox Jewelers, hoping to catch him while he was still on the clock. Jay's mother insisted that she accompany them. But when they arrived at the store, Jay wasn't there. A coworker told police that Jay had left only a few minutes before they arrived because he'd received a call about Beth's murder. Witnesses told police that Jay seemed angry when he left. When police were finally able to talk to Jay, they immediately noted that Jay matched the description they received of a man with brown hair and glasses abandoning Beth's car in a random neighborhood. During his interview, Jay told them that Beth arrived at his apartment around 8:45 p.m. on June 2nd. He stated that they started the movie Lethal Weapon 2 around 10:30 p.m. and they both fell asleep shortly after 11 p.m. Jay told police that he briefly woke up around 6:30 a.m. on June 3rd and saw that Beth was getting ready to leave. He claimed that she left shortly after that and he stayed in bed and went back to sleep. While interviewing Jay, police noticed that he had small abrasions on his hand and on one of his fingers. When they questioned him about the injuries, Jay allegedly became very emotional, and the interview abruptly ended when Jay's lawyer showed up. When police questioned other employees at the restaurant below Jay's apartment, they learned that one of the bakers arrived at the restaurant around 4:45 a.m. on June 3rd, and that she remembered seeing Beth's red car in the parking lot. The baker told police that around 6 a.m., she heard a loud noise coming from a back door. That back door provided access to the upstairs apartment. About an hour later, around 7 a.m., she saw Jay's mother outside. And sometime between 8:30 to 9 a.m., she saw Jay's mother in the basement, washing laundry that looked like bedding of some sort. It's important to note that when police did a cursory search of Jay's bedroom, his bed was stripped of its sheets. The baker told police that it was unusual to see Jay's mother up and about that early in the morning, particularly to do laundry. A custodian at the restaurant also claimed to have seen Beth's car in the parking lot around 6 a.m., corroborating the baker's story. A newspaper delivery man told police that when he delivered the paper between 6:45 and 7 a.m., there was no red car in the parking lot, but no one actually witnessed Beth's car leaving. Although they didn't have any direct evidence tying Jay to Beth's murder, investigators believed that they had enough circumstantial evidence to make an arrest. So on June 4, 1990, police arrested her boyfriend Jay and charged him with murder. But Jay's mother acted quickly and hired an attorney. And a few hours after his arrest, Jay made bail and was released. The $25,000 bail was actually paid by the owner of the restaurant where Jay's mother worked. Later, all charges against Jay were dropped due to a lack of evidence. While five of Beth's ex-boyfriends asked to be pallbearers at her funeral, Jay did not even attend the funeral. He never so much as sent her family a condolence card, and they never heard from him after Beth's murder. In 1991, Beth's family received a letter. To their surprise, it was from the owner of the restaurant who had paid Jay's bail to have him released. In the letter, the restaurant owner apologized to Beth's family, stating that he was deeply regretful about having paid to help Jay. He also stated that it was his belief that if he had not paid the bail so quickly, Jay would surely have cracked under the pressure and would have faced justice. Today, 33 years after Beth Beege's murder, the case remains unsolved. There are no official suspects, and no arrests have been made. If you have any information regarding the murder of Beth Beege on June 3, 1990 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, please contact the Milwaukee Police Department Cold Case Unit at 414-935-7360. Beth's brother, Bruce, has set up a Facebook page called Justice for Beth Beege, and he has also set up an email address where tips can be submitted at justiceforbethbeege@gmail.com. Beth loved to write and collect poetry, and in her honor, her parents chose a poem to read at her funeral. I want to close this episode with that poem. I'd like the memory of me to be a happy one. I'd like to leave an afterglow of smiles when life is done. I'd like to leave an echo whispering softly down the ways of happy times and laughing times and bright and sunny days. I'd like the tears of those who grieve to dry before the sun of happy memories that I leave when life is done. If you'd like to request a case to be covered on the show, you'll find a link to a case request form in the show notes. Please subscribe to the YouTube channel, where you'll find full episodes, complete with photos relevant to each case. You can follow the podcast on X, formerly Twitter, at Crime Again Pod, on Instagram at Crime Again Podcast, and on TikTok at Crime Again Podcast. Links to all social media can be found in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode of Crime and Crime Again.